Not really sure which day of the lockdown we are. 21? 22? Who cares? Let's get going with another podcast.
Hello, Dr. Steve here again, and this week we are looking at the concept of privacy, in particular with relation to technology and its context within digital ethics. So the basis for the podcasts this week will be from Herman Tavani's textbook, Chapter 5, which deals with privacy and cyber technology. We'll look at the concept of privacy and try to form some sort of definition. We'll look at it from the perspective of the uniqueness debate. So are privacy issues really unique in the technological world, or are they just the same old privacy issues, but we're just using computers? And then finally, in this particular podcast, we'll look at Helen Nissenbaum's framework. So Helen Nissenbaum is a fairly well-known digital ethicist, and she's written a lot on many of the issues within digital ethics, and she had a particular interest in the concept of privacy in around the early 2000s. So we'll look at her framework see if that makes much sense to us. So without any more messing about, let's get into it. So with regard to privacy and technology, we can pretty much say that the privacy issues related to technology affect almost all of us everywhere in the world, unless you live in some village that doesn't have electricity or any kind of technology whatsoever. If you live in modern Western society, the clash between technology and privacy has become very evident over the last 20 years or so. So if you think about the amount of personal information that might be collected about you from commercial transactions, when you go shopping, when you do your food shopping at the supermarket, if you swipe your Flybuys card, if you use a credit card, all of that information is collected in databases by banks, by supermarkets, and so on. And then if you think about the data that's collected by your mobile phone, almost all of us have smartphones these days, and an enormous amount of data is collected with your smartphone. Everything you do on your smartphone is collected by, potentially either by your service provider or by the smartphone maker, such as iPhone or Apple. If you use Google Maps, your GPS data is collected. There are situations where Bluetooth ID codes are collected off your phone if you're operating within an area where RFID or Bluetooth information is collected. It may not be personalized, but it's still information that's collected about you. Also, if you think of any of the applications that you use that are GPS enabled, location tracking turned off, but still information about your use of that app might be collected by the app's developers. If you're in a public place, you are potentially being watched by CCTV cameras. There's hundreds of them all over Wellington and all over Petone. So you might be just casually strolling through an environment and images are collected about you. If you use the internet, even if you just use the internet for just browsing around, your web browser, as you know, collects loads of information about your browsing habits and what time you're looking at certain websites, what websites you're going to. There's a saying that says your web browser knows more about you than even your closest friends or even your partner. This personal data is collected, and it could be sold by third party. It could be sold on to third party companies. If you use a Flybuys card or a customer loyalty card, often the privacy disclosures within the terms of conditions of use of those cards often say that the company can collect that data about you and sell it and will use it in any way they like. So, of course, these kinds of things bring up lots of different privacy issues that we might want to think about. The What I should say right now is that this talk roughly follows the slides, this privacy in cyberspace part one PowerPoint slides. So if you haven't got those open yet, you might want to open them. I'm currently sitting around slide number six. So if you wanted to open it up and flick through the slides as I talk, that might be of some use to you. Or you could just look at them at a different time. So the actually, and just as a sideline, one of the things that came up today, I've just been reading an article literally about 10 minutes ago before I started this podcast, is that with the COVID-19 virus, many countries are deciding whether to create mobile apps that they can use to digitally track people's location so that they can use that for trace tracking for people that have been in contact with the virus. And so this is currently being floated as an idea in Australia. The app hasn't been created or released yet, but the idea has certainly been talked about. It's been talked a little bit about in New Zealand as well. Potentially, if we come out of lockdown and go to level three, there may be some incentive to use an app like this, which will track your location and maybe track who you've been in contact with in order to receive some more freedoms if you're using their app. So this is a really interesting concept, because what it's saying is a government may say, hey, you can use this mobile phone application and you have to share some of your private data with us in terms of your location, where you're going, where you're moving to, backwards and forwards, in exchange for some particular freedoms. I'll come back to that issue a little bit later, maybe in podcast two, because it's a very interesting concept. So, in relation to the uniqueness debate, the idea here is, are the privacy issues related to technology any different to privacy issues before we had computing or before we had computer technology? So is privacy just privacy, regardless of whether you're using a computer or whether you're just existing in a little village that doesn't have technology at all? Your privacy can still be violated, or it still could be reduced in some way. So what is it about technology that makes it worth discussing privacy issues in relation to technology? So Tavani, and I'm up to slide seven here, by the way, if anyone wants to go through the slides. So Tavani argues that there are four kind of main ways that privacy concerns are exacerbated by cyber technology. So privacy is privacy, and it can be reduced or violated or compromised in some way. But there are four main ways that cyber tech or computer technology exacerbates privacy concerns. First of all, the amount of personal data that can now be collected, and also I would add the automation of the collection of that data. So the mere fact that you just use a mobile phone is that mobile phone is collecting vast amounts of data about your location, about your use of the app, whatever app you're using. Also, the speed, number two, the speed at which the personal information is exchanged. So at the speed of light, that data is then logged onto, or is input into some kind of computerized database and can be collected forever. So collected and saved and stored forever. So number three is the duration of time, which is essentially forever, as long as we've got hard drives and we can provide the electricity to store that data. And then finally, for the kind of personal data, such as digital transactional information that can be acquired, or maybe GPS data. So those are the four things that Tavani thinks make the privacy issues particularly unique to cyber technology: the amount of personal data, the speed at which it can be exchanged, the duration of time which it can be kept for, and the particular kind of data that may not be possible to collect without technology, such as GPS location data and stuff like that. So let's try and come up with some kind of definition of privacy. First of all, let's have a think about personal privacy. So when we talk about personal privacy, we often talk about it in terms such as the fact that your privacy could be lost, or it could be diminished, or it could be violated or breached, and so on. Right. So those are some of the terms that we use. So if we think of, and what Tavani does is he tries to sort of frame this as kind of a series of metaphors. So what he says is that he says privacy is sometimes viewed in terms of something that can be diminished. So if you think about your personal information that potentially could be eroded gradually or lost altogether. Or another way to think about privacy is with the spatial metaphor, so it can be intruded upon or invaded. So these are terms that are often used. My privacy has been invaded, and that tends to be a kind of spatial concept of privacy. And then if we think of privacy in terms of the confidentiality of our personal information, which might be stored in a database somewhere. So think about your personal information that's stored about you in Welltext database, for example, the enrollments database. If someone were to hack into that database and look at your information, then you might say that the confidentiality has been breached, or your privacy has been violated in some way. So that's some of the terminology. If we look at classical theories of privacy, so just for your information, I'm up to slide 10 at the moment, classical theories of privacy. There's usually a couple of different notions related to classical theories. So one is the concept of non-intrusion into one's space. So for example, if you're just sitting quietly at home watching TV and someone's peering through your window staring at you, then that's potentially an intrusion of your privacy into your personal space, right? The other concept in the classical theories is non-interference. So this is interesting because it's saying that privacy, some part of privacy relates to autonomy, your ability to make a decision without being interfered, and that relates to privacy as well. And then the idea that we have control or restrict the access to our personal information. So having some kind of control, just making decisions about who can access your personal information. So for example, you might have a Facebook page, you might make it private, only friends of friends can send you friend requests, only people that are not your friend can only see very limited types of things on your Facebook page. So that's the concept of you having control over your own personal information. So the non-intrusion theories of privacy view privacy as either being left alone to make your own decisions. And also an important point that Tavani makes is being free from government intrusion. Being free from government intrusion. So this is an interesting concept because it relates to the idea of us maybe having to have some kind of app if we want to come out of this lockdown with coronavirus. Something to think about. Then there are these other... So when computerized databases started emerging and concepts of privacy became important through the 1990s and into the 2000s, there were a few different variations on theories of privacy called control and limited access theories. And here's an interesting thing. The control and limited access theory of informational privacy is actually implemented in SQL databases. So you can... if you create an SQL database, you can create privacy settings around that database, making decisions about who gets to change things, who gets to insert data, who gets to update it, who gets to delete it, and so on. So that's quite an interesting concept. But we can look at this from a perhaps more philosophical perspective, talking about informational privacy and concerning that with how we protect our personal information in computerized databases. And we would, and I think most of you would agree that most of us wish to have some kind of control over our personal information, right? So in some cases, we might set up certain privacy zones or certain contexts or certain settings within applications and so on that limit people's access to your personal data. Good example of this is you can post an image on Facebook and you can decide who can view it. Can the public view it? Can only I have access to it? Can I choose selected friends that can see it, and so on, right? So that's how the concept of the control and limited access theory of informational privacy works. So then we get back to Jim Moore, our old friend Jim Moore, who's a very famous digital ethicist, and he has took these theories and came up with his own version of privacy, and it has three kind of elements to it. The first element is accessibility privacy, so the ability to access your own data and to not have other people access your data that you don't want to. Decisional privacy, which relates to the non-interference concept, and then the concept of informational privacy and controlling and restricting access to one's personal information. So according to Moore, his kind of definition goes like this, and this is a quote from slide 15 out of chapter 5 of Tavani. Moore's concept of privacy goes like this. An individual has privacy in a situation if in that particular situation the individual is protected from intrusion, interference, and information access by others. So if you've got that kind of protection from intrusion, from interference, and from informational access by others, and you make the decisions about who gets to see your data or who can have access to it, then you could argue that we have a robust concept of privacy there. Okay, moving on. Just a little bit more on Moore's theory of privacy, Jim Moore's theory. Moore's definition is his notion of a situation, right? So you might have heard me say a situation. An individual has privacy in a situation. And Moore kind of applies this to a range of contexts or zones. So, for example, an activity on the internet could be a situation, or a relationship could be a situation. So a relationship between you and your doctor, for example, where you share some information and you expect a level of privacy between that within that relationship. Or you might have information storage and access of information on the internet, and you get the choice about who you allow to have access to that information, right? Okay, now we get up to a fairly important point, because I ask a question about this in the quiz, and I ask questions in the revision questions as well. And Jim Moore distinguishes us between these two concepts of privacy. One is called natural privacy, and then the other one is the right to privacy, which is a normative concept of privacy. So natural privacy, let me try and give you examples. Moore would define natural privacy as, imagine that you're going for a walk on your favorite bush walk and it's all quiet, you're on your own, you're having a really nice time, just quiet alone time to yourself, walking through the bush, beautiful bush, and then someone catches up to you and starts chatting to you, and you're not interested in chatting to them, you were having a nice time walking on your own, doing your own thing, but this person catches up to you. So in this sense, you wouldn't say that your privacy has been invaded or violated, because it's just a natural concept of privacy. And you don't have a right to be there on your own, or you don't have this right that nobody should be able to be in the same place at the same time as you. Another example is, let's say you're sitting on a beach having a quiet little time on your own, just meditating, contemplating the universe, enjoying the sound of the sea and surf, and you're on your own, and then some idiot comes up and sits near you and starts looking at you, right? You can't argue that in that sense your privacy has been violated or invaded, right? That's what Moore wants to make the distinction between. So the other concept of privacy that Moore talks about is the right to privacy, and this is a more of a normative sense of privacy, which means that you have a right to privacy, and then if this level of privacy is breached or eroded, or you can have your privacy violated in this sense. So let me give you an example here. Let's say that you are at home sitting watching TV on your own, and somebody comes onto your property and starts looking at you through the window. Then that's a breach of your right to privacy. They don't have the right to come onto your property. They don't have the right to look through the window at you. Let's say your email account is hacked by somebody. a random person or a person that you know, that's also a breach of your right to privacy in a normative sense as well. So have a look at the, have a read of those in a little bit more detail in the text to get more of a concept, but that's a really important concept that's part of this podcast today. So you, so just to summarize that up, we can talk about the loss of privacy, which is very different to a violation of privacy, right? Walking through the forest on your own, somebody, you bump into somebody, that's a loss of privacy, but you don't have a right to have a private, to have privacy within that context, right? Remember, Moore talked about situations. So in that situation, you don't really have a right. It's fine for another person to walk past you. Or the other one is a violation of privacy. So have a think about those two, loss of privacy, violation of privacy, and see if you can come up with some examples. And there's a question in the quiz about that too. Okay, so the last few minutes, I'm just going to outline Nissenbaum's theory of privacy as contextual integrity, right? So Nissenbaum came up with this concept called contextual integrity, the contextual integrity concept of privacy. And how that works is that Nissenbaum's privacy framework requires that the processes used in gathering and disseminating information are A, appropriate to a particular context, and B, comply with the norms that govern the flow of personal information in a given context. So let me give you an example, right? We're talking about information here as being used appropriately within a particular context, and that the flow of that personal information is appropriate to the given context as well and complies with the norms of that context. Let me give you an example. You go to the doctor and you have a chat to your doctor. You've got some kind of ailment, something's wrong with you. Your doctor prescribes some medicine for you. You have a private discussion about your health with your doctor. He or she notes that information down in the database that's associated with you, your file on the database, for example. And then he writes a prescription for you. And then he faxes that, or he emails that prescription. Nobody uses faxes anymore. Why did I even say that? He emails that. Well, actually, the reason I said that is because I know for a fact that many pharmacies still use fax machines, which is absolutely crazy in this day and age. But that's why I said that, because I know that that's how the health sector still works. Anyway, getting back to it, your doctor emails your prescription through to the pharmacy, and there's some use of an information within a particular context there. There's a flow of personal information, and it complies with the norms, right, of that situation. So it's quite fine for your doctor to share that information with your pharmacy because your pharmacy needs to know what the details of your prescription are. Provided the security is implemented around the flow of that information, then that's completely fine. So that is an example of Nissenbaum's theory of privacy as contextual integrity. That's also another really important concept within this lecture today, so it's worth looking at that. So just to drill down a little bit more detail, Nissenbaum refers to two types of informational norms, right? So norms are just the appropriate way that we do something, right? So a norm of behavior when you go and visit your grandparents is that you're polite to them and you're respectful and so on. That's a norm of behavior. So a norm of behavior with relation to Nissenbaum's contextual integrity theory is norms of appropriateness. Appropriateness. So what are the appropriate behaviors around the use of this information? First of all, if it's a doctor, that the doctor keeps your information secure and safe and doesn't share it with anyone. And then also norms of distribution of that data. So it's completely fine for your doctor to share your prescription with the pharmacy, but not with anyone else, right? So please make sure that you study that, because that's kind of one of my favorite questions to ask in an exam. There's a couple of more slides left, but I think we've got the main concepts across. And let me see how this podcast has been going for over 20 minutes now, so it's a long one. So I'm going to call it a day here, and I'll upload this ASAP, and we'll get on to the second one. Should be up later in the day or tomorrow, perhaps. Thanks a lot.
These waves, radio waves, television channels, X-rays, and so on. Is a, and so on. Is a, and so on.